Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, Crystal Jones checks on those New Year's resolutions. Kentucky author and former poet laureate Richard Taylor is out with a new book about the influences of fathers, and we'll hear how the Kentucky Student Voice Team is making itself heard in Frankfort. First, we're joined by Matthew Howe, professor of government at Eastern Kentucky University. Professor Howe teaches policy analysis and program evaluation, which deals with understanding policies and programs, and then designing experiments to determine if the policy works. He's also interested in state and local politics, so I thought I would turn to Matthew to ask about the authoritarian inclinations being openly talked about by one of our leading presidential candidates, the implications for state and local government, and how citizens might be affected. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Howe.
Good to be here.
And, you know, I think many of us are searching for some kind of a compass to navigate this 2024 presidential election race. In our past, has there been anything remotely parallel to what we're witnessing now? We have a leading major party presidential candidate who's openly expressing disdain for democratic principles and rule of law. Is that unprecedented, or has it happened before?
That's actually much more common than Americans appreciate, especially if we go internationally. If we're comparing to the rest of the world, that's just Tuesday. But even in the United States, we've had this type of dispute going back at least as far as the election of 1800 and plausibly back to the election of 1796. It seems a little unusual to us because it didn't happen actually in the mid 20th century. We just hit it better in the mid 20th century. I was actually just reading an article. Lyndon Johnson's White House recordings were declassified a number of years ago. And there was a report, I think 2013 or so, they were going through Lyndon Johnson's reports. And they found all kinds of crazy stuff. Johnson had wiretapped Goldwater's campaign and had the CIA install spies in Goldwater's campaign. Meanwhile, Richard Nixon was back-channeling diplomacy with the South Vietnamese government during the Paris peace talks in order to delay any peace in the war. At least this was Johnson's take on it. I imagine Nixon had a different take. But they, this type of dirty trick stuff goes way, way back, but we didn't used to do it in public. Up until very recently, there was kind of an unstated agreement that these types of dirty tricks, Johnson just flat out says it, why he's not going to reveal this information about Nixon is that it would be destabilizing to public faith in the political system. And that's a paraphrase, not a quote. But that was the understanding, was that this type of stuff goes on, but it goes on behind closed doors. I don't know why. Maybe it's the internet. Maybe it's post-Nixon. Maybe it's something else. But we seem to be much more willing to have this go on in the open than we were 50 years ago.
That's really interesting. I think one huge change between those days and now would be that there was no internet. There were no smart devices, no Fox News, Newsmax, MSNBC, NPR, Instagram, TikTok. Conditions in those times bear little resemblance to those of today when we're talking about media and communication. Does this make a big difference in how we should be calibrating our expectations this time around?
I gotta say, I don't know. My take on this is that this is still fairly normal, but my reasons for not worrying too much about authoritarianism have less to do with the personalities involved and more to do with kind of larger structural aspect of the United States. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds here for your audience, but there's an article that I read many years ago. I believe it was Robert Dahl who wrote it, where he's talking about something else. But he offhandedly mentions in the article that the United States is very hard for authoritarians to control because the way that authoritarian systems work is you have power concentrated in one place. A couple of months ago, I was reading an Edward Luttwak book where he talks about launching coups in Africa. And you know, you're able to do this in Africa because they have very, very centralized governments. So six guys with guns, if they can get into the presidential palace and take over, everybody will just start taking orders from the new people. Right. That doesn't work in the United States. We have 50 states, which are all divided up into executive, legislative, and judicial branches. The federal government is divided up into the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. We've got 20-some-odd, I need to go back and count exactly, but 20-some-odd cabinet secretaries who all ostensibly work for the president, but also have their own agendas. We have independent commissions and independent agencies and taxing districts. There's no place where you can stand and you can control everything. Famously, Harry Truman said when Eisenhower won election to the presidency in 1950, he said he wished he could be in the room when Eisenhower shows up and says, do this, and nothing happens, right? And that's kind of the same thing going on today, right? The president shows up and says, well, I want to be a dictator. And 26 people in the room say, that's nice. I'm glad that's working for you. Why am I going to help you?
You can't exactly dictate if nobody takes the orders, huh?
Right.
And we kind of experienced that during the first Trump administration with Chief of Staff John Kelly and others who pushed back. To bring it way down to the local level, Lexington voters, for example, elect our council members on a nonpartisan basis to represent the districts where they live. Just for speculation's sake, let's say that it does happen and we do have an autocratic leader in the White House, and that emanates out to the federal bureaucracy. Control is taken over programs and agencies and so forth. What do you think would be the effect on the local civic institutions that we just expect to work, where political affiliation and partisan recrimination take a backseat to joint mission, which is kind of what we see happen in the Lexington City Council?
Rampant speculation. A lot of things could happen, ranging from basically nothing. It very much depends on what exactly happens. So the federal government doesn't have any direct control over state and local governments. State governments do have direct control over local governments, but even that's mediated by state law and by the political relationship between local and state government. So the only way that the federal government can get the local governments to go along with them is that the local governments have to agree. Now, there are a number of sticks that can be used and carrots that can be used to do that. The most famous ones are the funding mechanisms. So local governments rely very heavily on intergovernmental revenue in order to get projects done. A lot of healthcare programs are joint federal, state, local activities. A lot of aid for retired people, so like Meals on Wheels, might involve some federal funding, things like that. Highway funds for roads, which might be more of a state issue than a local issue, but nonetheless, local governments do get involved in laying out federal and state roads. You know, there are all of these funding mechanisms where local governments ask for support from the federal government. The federal government gives that support, but says there's strings attached. You have to do these things. The vast majority of the things that local governments have to do in order to get federal funds are actually just compliance issues. I could do an entire talk about how the compliance state is kind of screwing over small communities in Kentucky. But there are other potential strings attached. So you have a president who wants to start cracking down on, I don't know. I mean, like with Biden, we've seen attempts to crack down on pro-life activists. With Trump, you could see crackdowns on Black Lives Matter. You would have some mechanisms that you could use to do that at the presidential level. But for the most part, if the local governments don't want to go along, they just don't go along. So we saw this during the Black Lives Matter protests during the last year of Trump's administration. Local police departments just didn't want to do anything. So the federal government had to send marshals to do it, had to send its own police, which they don't have that many. There are multiple more local and state police than there are federal marshals to do anything. You know, again, the federal government can send its own marshals, but that's a limited resource. And so if a lot of local governments are like, yeah, no, we're not cracking down on these protests, get on with your life, that's what's going to have to happen. You know, again, if the president really wants to push it, they can do it using their own things, right? They've got the marshals, they've got the U.S. Attorney's Office, and we do see that historically going all the way back to the 1800s. But actual getting cooperation from the states, getting actual cooperation from the local governments is incredibly difficult. It's also more difficult to get buy-in from the states, because in the aftermath of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, the states brought a lawsuit about the expansion of the Medicaid program that went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court greatly curtailed the ability of the federal government to use unrelated funds to coerce local and state governments. So the previous precedent had been South Dakota v. Dole, which basically said that there was hypothetically an amount of money that the federal government could refuse to give to a state that would be considered commandeering, and that would be unconstitutional. But we're not going to state what it is. And then in Federation of Independent Business Owners, something like that, it's the Sebelius case. In the Sebelius case, the Supreme Court says, yeah, you cannot hold an entire chunk of a state's Medicaid funds hostage to this particular policy change. So that same precedent would apply to any police or other type of action going on in the future, where the federal government could not say, well, if you don't do this, we'll just pull all of your highway funds, right? That wouldn't go. That wouldn't fly.
I've heard numerous people my age say that they feel that 2024 could be the most consequential election year of their lives. I've heard it proposed that as it stands right now, the 2024 election's coming down to some sort of definitive test of our belief in our institutions, respect for diversity, commitment to law, our devotion to the truth. In your view, is that a reasonable assessment of where we are right now?
I've been hearing that since I was 4 years old. Every election since Bush, the first one, has been the most important election in my life. Maybe this one is. I'm tired of it. Like, I'll just confess, I have been hearing this since 1992. And I mean, I probably was hearing it in 1988. And I just have, if every election's the most important one in your life, then none of them are.
I have to say, I've been doing this for 55 years. In mm-hmm. Washington, D.C., New York, I've never seen one like this.
I remember 1996. That one was rough. Like every
refreshes what went on.
That's Dole v. Clinton. Mm-hmm. And so this is before, I believe, the actual Clinton impeachment, but this is after some of the major revelations about business dealings in Arkansas, possibly using the state patrol as a procurer of women for him. So that stuff was starting to come out prior to the election. And then you have Bob Dole, you know, World War II veteran, had been injured in combat. Mm-hmm. This venerable old senator from Kansas, and you know, decency is on the line. You know, if you believe in decency in the Oval Office, vote for Bob Dole. And then, you know, afterwards, you have the revelations about Monica Lewinsky. You know, and then everyone's like, "See, I told you, decency was on the ballot in 1996." And I don't think my students have any idea, recollection, like the cultural memory of 1996 has so vastly faded.
But I don't remember anybody, any candidate, actually suggesting or encouraging violence, talking about the final battle. Mm-hmm. The rhetoric has become pretty extreme, wouldn't you say, compared to those days?
No.
I don't honestly, Matthew, I do not recall Bill Clinton or Bob Dole using that kind of rhetoric.
Military rhetoric in campaigns goes back hundreds of years. I remember the kerfuffle about Sarah Palin putting targets on a congressional seats map. I don't remember what year that was. I remember discussion about Civil War. I spent all of my college years looking at people putting up that famous map of the United States of Canada and Jesus Land, talking about Civil War and division. Mm-hmm. And so that would have been 2004 or so.
Right.
I mean, maybe this is just the difference between you remember the middle of the 20th century. So you remember when this was all kept under wraps and when this was, below the surface or not talked about in public before the internet. I grew up in the internet, man. I've been seeing Civil War memes since I was 18.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder what we're experiencing today feels like something of a referendum on where we are. As a professor of government, do you find this to be a pretty teachable moment? Is this what we're going through useful to you in educating?
In some ways. If it gets my students interested, I'm happy with that. Uh-huh. I mean, I should also say, I'm not exactly thrilled with where American politics has been since I was 18. I do have the perspective to recognize that where it's been since I was 18 is not, again, it's not particularly new. You go back to the 19th century, accusations of treason and monarchism are common. Accusations of republicanism, as in French republicanism, so guillotines and on the mall kind of republicanism, are common throughout the 19th century. So I have the perspective to know that what we're going through is fairly normal for the rambunctiousness of American politics. But I also got just enough of the tail end of that Cold War consensus that I do miss it. There is something to be said for people, you know, for certain things you just don't do in public. You know, like you can, Nixon famously, Johnson famously had enemies lists. They hated each other intensely. I used to work in a congressional office. I talked to members who intensely hated each other, but would not show it in public. It was considered a losing of face to be in public and demonstrably mad at someone. And those days are gone. Right. You now have senators and members of Congress openly talking in Congress about how much they hate each other. I mean, if you remember the shock it was when Dick Cheney told a senator to f*** himself on the Senate floor. Mm-hmm. Like I don't know that it's commonplace anymore, but it wouldn't be the deal it was when Cheney did it back during the Bush administration. So, yeah, I'm in total agreement that things are not in a place that I'm totally fond of. So in that regard, you know, like I'm sad that this is what gets my students interested. On the flip side, so many of my students are disinterested in politics that if it does get them interested in learning that, you know, actually American politics can be very significant. It's very rambunctious. People get into it with each other. And for good or for ill, we do it in public now.
What I'm hearing from you is that you have some pretty strong faith in the structure of this country.
I do.
That's reassuring.
Yeah.
Well, that's Matthew Howell, a professor of government here at Eastern Kentucky University. We appreciate your time and a really spirited, interesting conversation, Matthew.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on.
Joining us now is Zachary Clifton, a senior at Corbin High School and legislative policy coordinator for the Kentucky Student Voice Team. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Zachary.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I really appreciate this opportunity, not only to talk to you, but also to be able to represent my generation and people my age.
Well, my understanding, Zachary, is that as part of the Kentucky Student Voice Team and as a coordinator of KSVT's policy team, you're helping other students follow the legislative session and help amplify student voices to inform these public conversations about issues that are important to them. And given that most of your colleagues are too young to vote right now, they will be soon, what are some strategies that you use to make sure students are heard by policymakers?
Tom, I think the distinction that you're making is especially important and one that I'll even restate for emphasis. So to your point, my team is too young to vote. And so given that, I think it's important that we pursue alternative avenues in how we express our voices and making sure that we really are heard in Frankfurt. And so to your question, I think that we are achieving this through several ways. And I think, you know, we're in regular communication with legislatures in Frankfurt. That's our primary way of achieving that kind of visibility that you're talking about. But I think, too, one way or the other, we've gotten that attention of policymakers. As you know, obviously, the Education Committee meets during school time right at 8 a.m. And that leaves it almost impossible for education stakeholders like myself to interact with policymakers. But the simple fact is that our team is very active in communities around Kentucky. I think you can find our team in the opinion section of the Courier Journal and the Herald Leader. But I think you can also go more directly to our website where we actively track, obviously, over 20 bills. And these are bills that are being heard by the General Assembly, even things that we've kind of worked alongside to make sure that the General Assembly was hearing. And so the bottom line, Tom, is that, yes, my team is by and large too young to vote, but we are still being heard. We know that our voices are being heard loud and clear in Frankfurt, and that is a direct result of the kind of advocacy and outreach that we've been doing day in and day out since the beginning of the legislative session.
Okay, well, lots to talk about there. Let's begin with too young to vote, because we know that time flies, and that isn't going to be the case for very long, is it?
Certainly not.
So what policy issues concern you the most? You mentioned education. Of course, I'm sure that's high on your list. But what are the issues that that you're concerned about, in particular in this session?
Yeah, so there's so much going on in Frankfurt right now. And I think, too, the policy issues that concern me the most are really the ones that are a little more broad. The ones regarding the education funding and the way that our educational system is funded. So, for instance, I think you can look at proposals such as, you know, House Bill 2, which is kind of a referendum for charter schools. And that's a bill, like I said, you know, that's been introduced and is going to be putting that choice to the ballot box for voters to decide on. And I think it's bills like this that concern me because of this bill's realistic and sort of tangible threat. But more broadly, bills like that are what I'm looking at. And I think with specifically House Bill 2, you know, you've probably seen where even the chairman of the House Education Committee, Representative Tipton, recently predicted that this measure really is kind of likely to pass in the General Assembly. And so at that point, we kind of already have an indication that voters in November will likely be voting on this. Unfortunately, however, I think we also know that charter schools are always marketed as school choice, when in fact, in reality, this would really just cause a more inefficient, inequitable, and inadequate allocation of resources in Kentucky's educational landscape. To me, it's a mandate and a charter for some of the disparities to become even more polar than they already are today with what we're seeing with funding in the educational system.
Well, you and the Kentucky Student Voice team have a pretty ambitious initiative going on right now, and it engages both youth and adults all across the Commonwealth. It's called the Rose Revival Campaign. It's all about revisiting the 1989 landmark state Supreme Court decision called Rose versus Council for Better Education. What more can you tell us about that?
Our Rose Revival Campaign has been, to me, an incredible public-facing, community-based, youth-led sort of series of events from communities all across Kentucky. So we've been everywhere from Corbin, my hometown, to Louisville and Bowling Green. And soon we will be coming back here to Eastern Kentucky on March 2nd to hear from stakeholders in Hazard, Kentucky. To your question, Tom, something that has stuck with me since day one is really just the sheer participation and interest in these forums. I think these forums have given us a direct line of communication to not only the public, but also to education leaders, decision makers, policymakers, really from all around the Commonwealth, as I noted before. But I think, too, something that really captures the power of the movement at a more macro national level is a story from one of our partners, Professor Michael Gregory from Harvard Law School's Youth Advocacy and Policy Lab. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention his daughter, who is a first grade student in Massachusetts. And so this Rose decision, which originated in our state Supreme Court, has really had effects that have reverberated throughout the United States, effects that have been felt by thousands of students in the last 30 some years since the decision. In Massachusetts, they have adopted the seven capacities of the Rose decision, which means, frankly speaking, Professor Gregory's daughter is actually getting an education that is not so dissimilar to the one that students in Kentucky are really supposed to be getting.
That's a key word right there, supposed to be. And I wanted to ask
exactly.
You, why does Rose need to be revisited?
In our eyes, the legislature and policymakers and education decision makers have been failing our schools and not adequately funding them for some time now. And so I think to your question, talking about what our schools are really supposed to be, they are supposed to be equitable and they are supposed to provide students with an adequate education. And I think the funding disparities and the lack of willingness from the General Assembly to sort of work to resolve some of those issues has really resulted in the kind of disparity that I enumerate when I'm talking about the difference between education in Massachusetts and Kentucky. And that really is at the heart of the Rose decision, this kind of idea that a decision which originated here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, which is being executed in other states, which is providing a direct benefit to students in other states and their education, is really not being felt as well here at home. Students really aren't receiving that kind of robust and liberal form of education that was outlined in Rose. And so to me, it's really anecdotes like that that kind of frame and underscore not only the importance of Rose, but also our larger public engagement campaign.
The state Senate has passed and sent over to the House Senate Bill 6, which is aimed at curbing diversity, equity, and inclusion in higher education. Do you have concerns about that legislation?
My first concern with Senate Bill 6 is that my viewpoints of divisive concepts, sort of to directly quote the bill, are entirely divergent from that of the General Assembly. However, I think my second concern is really the idea that they're trying to keep divisive concepts out of higher education in the first place. To me, considering that, my question is why? I can't understand why our colleges and universities can't keep their current status of being these sort of hosts of free speech and also being environments where people can really come together, discuss, debate ideas, regardless of how controversial or how divisive they are. And so to me, Senate Bill 6 and also its proponents are eagerly advocating for a sort of real-life ministry of truth, if you will. And it's ironic to me that certain leaders in the General Assembly simultaneously tout free speech, but also want control over the content of the discourse taking place in college campuses all across the Commonwealth.
Would you say that your peers are misunderstood about how much they care about politics, elections, and voting? And could what you just cited be a reason for a feeling of disenfranchisement?
I think my peers do care about politics, but I think that not all of them would care in the sort of way that the question is framed. So I think a lot of my classmates and friends even do feel disempowered and discouraged from politics. I would kind of liken it almost to the P word, Tom. And I think that they are more comfortable talking about politics without that sort of label. Mm-hmm. And I think if you ask my generation about how they feel about, you know, our warming planet, our schools that are increasingly vulnerable to gun violence, which, as you know, is the leading cause of death of people my age, you will get a response that sort of contradicts what I was talking about initially. And that is a response that is visceral, that is educated, that is informed, but most importantly is also incumbent of my peers' agency, which we do have. And I think my peers' agency is obviously something that so often is left out of these conversations and results in a lot of the confusion and mistakes and misconceptions about people my age.
I understand, Zachary, that you and a few other Kentucky high school students are going to be going to Harvard in Cambridge shortly to deliver a guest lecture about your work. Did I get that right? Kentucky high school students are about to deliver a guest lecture at Harvard Law School?
Yeah, so Tom, that is correct. We'll sort of be guest lecturers at Professor Gregory's class, our partner that I mentioned earlier. His class is titled The Art of Social Change, and we are really looking forward to sort of describing some of the system changes that we have advocated for here in Kentucky, obviously some of the ones that I've even mentioned to you in this interview. And I think that that recognition and that inclusion of high school students and young people at an institution like Harvard Law School is historic. And I think it's also representative of the kind of generational shift that we're advocating for at the Student Voice team.
Well, I've also heard that in addition to your interest in public policy, that you've written commentary on a whole range of policy issues in a variety of local and national news outlets. What is it about writing about policy issues for an audience in this way that's important to you?
So I think what's been most important to me in writing a lot of this is the fact that my fundamental beliefs and my concern with a lack of youth voice and also student perspective in the media kind of represents this idea that the narratives in our media about young people are sort of about us rather than by us. And I think with each successive story that I've written or that I've been a part of, it has been about the sort of small and incremental shifts to including my generation in narratives about ourselves. And kind of going back to what I said initially, we are being left out of these narratives about ourselves. Stories are being written about us instead of with us. And so I think every time I've had an opportunity to really express my opinion on a lot of these policy issues, I've taken that opportunity. And I think young people have been harmed for a long time not being included in this coverage of themselves. And that's really at the heart of what I've done in that journalism.
Well, I want to say to you right here and now that the door here at Eastern Standard is propped open for you for that very purpose, because I agree with you. And how quickly we forget that we were once in your shoes. Zachary Clifton, senior at Corbin High School, legislative policy coordinator for the Kentucky Student Voice Team. Thank you so much, Zachary.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Coming up after the break, Tom Eblen visits with Richard Taylor about his nonfiction book, Fathers, and remind us again, why do we make those New Year's resolutions? I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. The Black and Lit Book Club at Lexington's Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning will discuss Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghost by former Kentucky Poet Laureate Crystal Wilkinson, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern, March 11th on Zoom. For more information and to register, visit carnegiecenterlex.org. The Mountain Arts Center in Prestonsburg will host the 2024 Appalachian Arts and Entertainment Awards, 6 p.m. March 16th. The Appies seek to celebrate art in all its forms in Appalachian communities. For more information and to purchase tickets, visit macarts.com. And the Kentucky Arts Council will present the Kentucky Crafted Market, March 9th and 10th at the Kentucky Horse Park's Alltech Arena. Admission is free. For more information, visit the Arts Council's website, artscouncil.ky.gov. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
We've been getting some hints of spring, although we all know that it can snow in Kentucky as late as around Derby Day in early May, so still time to burrow in with a good book. Encouraging that is one of Tom Eblen's missions in his series on Kentucky authors.
Richard Taylor is a former Kentucky Poet Laureate and a retired professor at Kentucky State University and Transylvania University. He is the author of 12 books of poetry, 2 novels, and now 5 books of nonfiction. His latest work, titled Fathers, was issued recently by Accents Publishing of Lexington. It's part memoir about his own father and others, part family history, and part meditation on father figures, the roles they play in his life and the roles they play in all of our lives. Richard is here today to talk with us about his book, Fathers. Richard, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Happy to be here, Tom.
Well, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I've reached a stage in my life where I ask the question, what has made me who I am. And it occurred to me that, as Wordsworth said, the child is father of the man, and we are all the children of many fathers, as well as mothers. This is not a sexist book. And in thinking about the memories that stood out about my own father, who's been dead 50 years, was born, 119 years ago, I found little shards of memory, and that in some way I thought could be assembled to make sense out of his influence on my upbringing and the person, whoever that is, that I became. But it also included other individuals, mentors, two wonderful maiden lady cousins who lived in the country where I visited quite often, and as well as people who had an influence on my life. And that's why I say I think we're all the children of many fathers.
Well, tell us a little about your father, Joe Taylor, or Buzz, as everyone
calls
him.
Joe Taylor was the last of his generation to live on a farm. His family for generations had been farmers outside of Louisville, right on the Jefferson County, Oldham County line. In fact, I write a chapter about visiting the 1800 double pin log cabin that still stands, and until recently I did not know was my triple great grandfather's house, built before 1800. He was an attorney, but I think his heart was really in the country. I mentioned my cousins who lived on a farm outside of Louisville. He sort of adopted them, or they sort of adopted him in a way, because when he wasn't practicing law, which was nothing but it wasn't a passion with him, he was gardening. He had wanted to be he wanted to be a landscape architect, and he found out, ironically, that he could not draw. I say ironically because on my mother's side of the family, half of them were artists, and somehow he missed that boat by a generation. He practiced law, and when he wasn't practicing law, he was tending an enormous garden, sharing the bounty of that garden with neighbors and friends. He also kept an orchard. I have to this day his library, maybe 150 or so books on the apples of New York or how to grow grapes in your backyard. He was really passionate about those things. And so because he had always been something of a mystery to me, he was not a gabber, as I am, certain questions were raised about, well, who is this person and what made him tick? And I concluded, at least tentatively, that he led a kind of double life, a kind of button-down collar existence in downtown Louisville, where I clerked for him for a couple of years when I was in law school, and the sort of free experience of hopping in his vintage Jeep and driving 10 miles out to this wonderful farm, which sadly now is a subdivision, as so many farms surrounding Louisville are.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned the artists in your mother's family. One of them you write about, Lewis Day, your uncle,
right,
who was an artist. I think he was the art director at the Courier-Journal at the time. Why did you want to include him? How did
I wanted to include him because I can directly attribute to him my love of language and my love of history, as well as art. And when I was 13 or 14, he gave me a subscription to what at that time was called the Landmark Series, published by Random House. And what it did was embody key facets and personalities, biographies really, of persons significant in American history. That gave me a love of history. Language, he constantly quizzed me about language, what given words meant, and he encouraged me to keep word lists, which I dutifully did for a good while. Art, because he was more a designer than an artist, though I have a couple of his paintings, and he was an avid photographer, but he always aspired to be that artist, that the world of the imagination was important to him. And so, coupled with the influence of my father, who was very down to earth, quite literally, the two, I think, in some ways created a kind of composite individual.
Mm-hmm. One thing I thought was particularly interesting about this book, you know, as I said, it's part memoir, it's a part family history. But I thought it would be a really interesting vehicle for a lot of people who would like to kind of get down their own memories of their father or mother or parents, and also what they know about their family history. And this, it's kind of a good model for that. What kind of advice would you give people who are interested in doing what you did?
I would say don't worry about creating a seamless narrative. To sit down and maybe make a few notes about key memories in your life. They might be momentous. They might be very insignificant or seemingly insignificant. And start trying to assemble those in some sort of order, probably a chronological pattern. And it's amazing how much comes back to you once you get on that path. Another key element, I think, is quizzing your peers. My brother, my sister, both gave me, as well as some others, gave me information and insights into just who my father was. And I tried to assemble those things, not in any real definite order, and cobble them into a narrative.
Mm-hmm. What do you think you learned from doing this?
I learned, I suppose, that going back to another of my mentors, Guy Davenport, that art is the replacement of indifference by attention. And attention simply means writing down what is significant or finding a way to make that memory indelible. In my own case, I figured out before I came in here today that I've been keeping a journal for 40 years now, every day. And although I didn't use that so much as a resource, it was a means of creating habits of mind in which events take on significance or insignificance. They gave me a kind of filter through which to measure experience. And that's, I suppose, the fruits of that experience, fragmented as they are what make this a book.
Well, it's a really interesting book. And once again, the book is called Fathers by Richard Taylor, published by Accents Publisher. Richard, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
For the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, this is Tom Eblin reporting for WEKU's Eastern Standard.
So here it is, many, many weeks since January 1st. Did you make a New Year's resolution?
How's it going? Or has it already gone?
Eastern Standard's Crystal Jones.
I don't make resolutions. I haven't since I was a kid and figured out that most people don't keep them anyway. Why schedule a failure for the new year, I thought. If that feels a bit pessimistic, it's estimated that only around 9% of Americans keep their annual resolve to lose the weight or save the money. No one likes to experience failure, and we don't tend to talk about it, but that's what Quitter's Day is for. The majority of us tend to give up on our resolutions about the same time each year. The second Friday in January is known as Quitter's Day, and statistically, the time when most of us call it a year on the resolutions. Because if we all quit together, no one can point any fingers, apparently. January was named for the Roman god Janus, who looked forward to new beginnings as well as backward for reflection and resolution. A Boston newspaper from 1813 featured the first recorded use of the phrase New Year's resolution. The article states, Quote, "And yet I believe there are multitudes of people accustomed to receiving injunctions of New Year's resolutions who will sin all the month of December with a serious determination of beginning the new year with new resolutions, new behavior, and with the full belief that they shall thus expiate and wipe away all their former faults." End quote. It's that last part that I find fascinating, the idea of wiping away your former faults. But what about those among us who do this every year? Humans typically tend to avoid the things, even the things that we're proven to be good at sometimes, for fear of failure. So why doesn't the failure of a resolution keep us from making more? It turns out there's a scientific explanation, and it's called the fresh start effect. I phoned over to the psychology department here at EKU to find out more.
Absolutely, Crystal. My name is Rachel Savengros. I am a licensed psychological associate. I am a staff therapist here at the EKU Counseling Center, as well as the outreach coordinator.
So, my first question for you is, did you yourself make any New Year's resolutions?
I did. And these are resolutions I made last year, and they really worked well for me. So I made resolutions of be generous and grateful. Those are my two that I think has served me well last year. And I kind of wanted to do it again this year and just see what I can do.
Mm-hmm. So how are the resolutions going? Do you feel like you're doing a pretty good job at those?
I think I am. And one of the things that I like about choosing, you know, like a character trait or something like that is because even if I'm not, just noticing and remembering my mantras help me too. It's all about the reflection piece. So yeah, I think it's going quite well. Thanks.
When someone fails repeatedly, like at something, mm-hmm. even if they're really good at it, it can make them hesitant to try again. So why doesn't breaking resolutions have this effect on people?
Resolutions. So when you think about, I mean, the fresh start effect, just that phrase, it's almost like something I hear a lot of other clients talk about is the clean slate. They just want to get to a point where they feel like it's a new beginning for them. And just in that phrasing, that's kind of calling back something that's, some people call it like a temporal reset or something, the perception of just that time. So yeah, there's a lot of power behind the person's perception of when is the time to do a thing. And, you know, there's a lot of support behind if we as a society have decided that for New Year's, you make a resolution, and there is some power behind that, at least getting you thinking about and reflecting on the changes you want to make. The linchpin is actually removing your perception from the fresh start and you deciding when that fresh start is for you. So when you think of a fresh start, you're thinking of it as a distancing yourself from failure. Not only are you getting like this upcoming horizon of this socially accepted newness, this fresh start of the year, but you're also getting the benefit and the draw of distancing yourself from your perceived failures.
Well, there is a quitter's day, and it's usually recognized as around the second Friday in January, that if you're going to give up, mm-hmm. you'll give up by then. And I wondered, do you think it makes it easier on that other end of the spectrum to commit this repeated failure, so to speak, if we know that, well, everybody else is failing too, just like everybody else is making resolutions, they're all giving up on them too.
It does kind of help soften, you know, the perception of failure. But also, like you're saying, it does provide a sense of comfort and understanding with not reaching a goal. How relatable is that? You know, people relate to each other through failure. And I don't know of anyone who hasn't failed. And I don't know any other more relatable topic than sharing in failures with others. But I do think having a quitter's day is another reminder that, you know, it's part of the process of growing is stumbling, falling, and perceived failure, and then regrouping and overcoming with our next decided fresh start.
Is there a certain measure of time that needs to elapse before this can actually work, before this fresh start can feel like it's going to happen again?
I don't think so, no. I mean, a lot of things can affect that, but really where the magic happens is in the process of trying to achieve your goal. It's really all about how you go about making your goals. Really understanding how to create a goal, I think, is more impactful than when you start creating a goal.
Psychologically, what would you say are the benefits of the fresh start effect? Is this more of a trick of mind, or is this something that we should actually look at, a skill or a tool that we can use to build on a resolution with?
So it is like a psychological trick a little bit of, you know, the power of now. There is something to be said about being able to compartmentalize pieces of your perceived failure.
What would be your advice to pick that back up if they wanted to? How can they do that using maybe the fresh start effect and do it with the same enthusiasm that they had when they first made the resolution earlier in the year?
The fresh start works because we, as the human animal we are, has decided that this is a time to start the process of change. We all agree on it. Whether it's marketing or whatever, it's decided. So it's a significant time in our culture to make resolutions and to set our intentions. Okay, so you are enthusiastic about setting new intentions, but lose motivation throughout. And so what you do to keep that motivation is to try to reactivate that same thing. Find special times to give yourself a fresh start. As a scientist, you know, you learn the most from your failures, right? By looking at the fresh start as an opportunity to go back and run your data again and run that experiment called life again, I think, I don't know, for me, that is what keeps me motivated, is practicing getting used to going back to the drawing board and reorganizing my methods. Because the goal isn't the problem, especially if it's been on my goal list for years and years and years. I want to do this. You know you want to do it. So how can you better help support yourself through it? And if you're motivated and that motivation helps you, try to reignite motivation in different ways by picking significant times and by giving yourself opportunity to reflect on it. How well are you doing towards this goal that you want?
I'm doing great, because I didn't make any resolutions. But if you did, that's okay too. And I hope we've shared some motivation that can give you a fresh start. For Eastern Standard, I'm Crystal Jones.
Next week, episode 2 in our series Democracy Optimist, hosted by University of Kentucky election law and voting research professor Josh Douglas, will look at voter turnoff.
There is a fine line between very loudly advocating for change and then going so far that you sort of push people over to thinking that there's no point, and there's no point in engaging with the system at all.
Jessica Huseman, the editorial director at VoteBeat.org, is joined by CivicLec's executive director, Richard Young, on why it's so important to vote in local elections.
It's the level that's closest to you. It's the level which people have the most hope and haven't gotten jaded on, like they have on national politics. And it's the level that it's the easiest to impact.
Democracy Optimist, next week on Eastern Standard. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Thanks to Otis Redding and Carla Thomas for New Year's resolution. We're online at esweku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.